All right, everybody, welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush.
Innovation Crush.
I thought you were going to forget. You were leaning back. And
I know. I tried to trick you.
Yeah, you can't trick me. It's virtually impossible.
Did you give me a water?
Technically, that's mine, but you can have it.
You're greedy. You have like three.
No, this is empty one left over from...
That's not empty.
It's even warm. It's like it's got the heat bubbles in it. It's disgusting.
Okay.
So thank you for that banter. My name is Chris Denson, and in case you guys don't know, that guy's name is Robert Donez Jr.
That's this guy.
And this is Innovation Crush, where we kind of look at really cool trends and people in the marketplace that are doing the awesome things that we all love. And in front of me today is Chantel Tibbles.
Hello.
How are you doing? Do we say the "and" or is the "and" silent?
The "and" is silent.
Oops. It's on everything.
It is on everything. You know, when I was an undergrad, I had this professor named Patricia Juliana Smith, and I was like, damn, someday I'm going to be Chantel Ann Tibbles. I mean, I've always been Chantel Ann Tibbles, but I was going to write my full name.
You're
out.
Like, I'm going to be every syllable that was given
all
to me.
All 21 letters of it.
Let's see. I'm John Christopher Denson. I don't know how many.
That's a lot of letters, too.
Yeah. So this interview's over. No.
Done.
So we were up all night researching on this topic. So
you know, many people are up researching this topic.
Very, very extensive research. tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do, because I'm going to botch the introduction. So I'm going to, like, you tell me a little bit of your story. Sociologist by nature.
I'm a sociologist, both naughty and by nature. Just kidding.
Wow. Did you just make that up now?
I did, actually.
That was good.
Right
that
now
was good.
When I was coming. But
it's better
I was
than
listening
Chris's
to
jokes.
The, thank you.
Hey,
I was listening
hey.
To the old school hip-hop station on my way down here. So,
nice.
You know. I am a sociologist, born and raised in Los Angeles. I have a PhD. I'm 36 years old, and I study the adult entertainment industry.
How long have you been 36? When's your birthday?
January. So I'm recently
January what?
36. 19th.
I'm the 6th.
Wow.
Happy
Capricorn.
Belated.
Capricorn, thank you.
When's your birthday?
July 8th.
Hmm.
Send gifts to Robert.
Sociology is the study of humans interacting in and with society. So basically what I do is try to make sense of patterns and processes I see occurring in social behavior.
Yes, basically. People often mix up sociology with psychology, which is the study of what is happening inside your brain. And also, I'm noticing more and more, with me in particular, I get mixed up with sexology, which is like the study of sex behavior, sex entertainment, sex industry, sex work, sex toys, sex.
So broad.
Sex, anything sex related.
Right.
I am a sociologist, which is patterns and processes in wider society and trying to make sense out of that. And, you know, when I first started out doing what I do, which was in my, like, early to mid-20s, I was studying worker rights, so labor, occupational structure,
right.
Whatever. And then through this various stuff, I started to realize that this adult industry, which is situated here in this delightful city where we all are at, needed some labor and occupation and rights looking at. So I started doing that, and as I got further
How did you find it? How did you make that jump? Were you just doing some online search, and you're like, or you had a friend, or like what? You're like, hey, Randall, I noticed you've been doing all these films, but you're still broke. No, how do you make that jump?
You know, honestly, it was really, like, complicated and whatever, but I'll tell you the brief version. I went to UCLA as an undergrad. And when I finished that up, I was like, I don't know what to do with my life. So I'm going to go get a master's degree in sociology. So I did that. And I actually went to Cal State Northridge, which is in the San Fernando Valley.
Right.
And when I was there, I was studying all this stuff about sex and body and feminism and gender and blah, blah, blah. And I was learning that sex work was this touchy subject. They didn't say sex work back then, though, but, you know, prostitution and dancing and whatever.
Right.
Touchy subject. And that porn was the most touchy and holy bad.
Literally touchy.
Yes, literally touchy and just terrible for so many reasons. And so I was like, oh my God, this is terrible. And then I learned that it was all like happening. It was all going down in the valley.
Yeah, like right where you, right underneath your feet.
It's another joke.
Going down in the, this is going to be, okay.
I know, I guess you're doing sound effects here. So anyway, it was situated right where I was. And I was like, no way. How can there be all of this trafficking and danger and horror and illegal and kidnapping and corruption and blah, blah, blah. How can all of this be happening right here in the Valley? The Valley seems like a nice place. And it shocked me. And then I started reading statistics and numbers, and I was like, how the hell can, where are the LAPD? Like, what is happening?
Well, isn't LA like number three on the list of like human trafficking cities in the world?
It might be. I don't know.
I thought I heard that stat.
I've heard that the most is like somewhere up north in the Midwest, but I don't know because I don't study human trafficking.
Sure.
Tangential. But the thing though is that I was like, how can this be happening? And here, and then I started kind of poking around a little bit, and I was like, wait a minute, this is Southern California. There are no basements. There's no sex torture basements. There is no, like, trafficking. I don't see it. I don't see how it happens.
Right.
I was so, like, such a little nerd.
now you're investigating.
I was investigating. I literally was, like, I was spying people in Starbucks. I'm like, how can that girl be out here? Like, I thought she was a slave. Like, what's happening? Oh, my God. I thought she was a kidnap victim. And, you know, I'd see that. Or how could there be, like, there's that business. Like, I see the logo on the door. Or I see the truck parked in the back. How can, that's right there in the Valley, in this commercial, industrial, whatever park. How can all that crime be happening right there? I started to realize after a lot of nerdy traversing of the Valley that there was this big disconnect, that I didn't know what was going on in the Valley, actually, because I knew nobody, was not connected to it in any way, shape, or form. But I was suspicious that it was this all bad, horrible thing that I was reading about in school. So I started to kind of piece together this puzzle that seemed really interesting. I've always been a fan of the underdog or the shadow or whatever, like always. I mean, it's always been my fight. And I really just started getting interested in it. I kind of learned the structure of the industry, started presenting my ideas. At this point in time, I had moved on to Austin, Texas. That's where I got my PhD from UT. And then I started getting all of these great reactions from other scholars and other members of the academic community, namely like, oh my gosh, get away from me. This is horrible.
the bad recognition.
And I became known as, I don't even tell you the things I became known as, but people were really
Give us one thing.
Well, there was a rumor when I was in grad school, there was a rumor going around that I was a stripper. Which was interesting because I've never been a dancer or a stripper or anything. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that occupation.
Can you actually dance, though?
Like,
not that kind of dance, but
really,
just like if we turn
like
on
Mary
some...
Mary Catherine Gallagher type of way.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So you
Cha-cha slide?
So it's nothing we want to see. But it was just interesting because there's a... And something I've actually written about in my work, this kind of sex worker stigma that happens. And it's interesting because people who work behind the scenes in porn get a lot of it. They get this association. So just by proxy, they get this measure of discrimination and stigmatization. And it was funny because I noticed that even with myself. I was like, wait, I'm exploring this. Like, you're talking about LGBTQ health, and you're talking about, you know, HIV, AIDS transmission in Brazil, and I'm talking about adult entertainment as a workplace with labor inequality. Nobody's talking about you being Brazilian. No one's talking about you being married. Why am I now a stripper? Which, what? But, I mean, it's not even what I was studying, but it was interesting. So it was a difficult kind of thing.
Well, why is it so taboo, right? Like, because there is this, like, disparagingly different, like, sex happens, right?
Yeah,
and sometimes it happens on camera, right?
At least three times this conversation.
And oddly enough, like, I read a statistic earlier that said something about, like, the percentage of STD transmissions in the adult industry is far less than the public sector, right? Like the,
that you know, is a true fact.
So you know, why is there such a huge, like, why were you shunned to an extent in the professional community? You know, what was the difference? What were people afraid of?
I honestly think it's twofold. First is that sex makes people uncomfortable.
I beg to differ, young lady.
I don't mean uncomfortable in a good way. I mean sex really, like, the idea of having the talk with your adolescent or your young person. The fact that I can still talk about sex behavior in my sociology classes when I'm teaching at a university, and it's always everybody's favorite day. Like, oh my gosh, nobody's ever said sex in front of the class. It's bizarre. But I mean, I think it has to do with our historical roots as a country and a culture. For whatever reason, we are so weird about sex. And we're also weird about, like, well, this is the kind of sex I want to have, but this is the kind of sex I feel like I should be having. And you really see a lot of people who get very twisted up about right. sexuality. So as a culture, I think, I honestly think that we struggle with this as a people, as a U.S. population.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you see folks in porn, the performers, and we don't, for whatever reason, we're not critically equipped to go, okay, Fast and Furious part whatever is a movie. Vin Diesel's not really doing that. That's not really happening. Okay, I got that. This Tom Cruise action movie, not real. This space movie, not real. Entertainment, Gravity, Sandra Bullock is not a researcher, blah, blah, blah. We can get that. But then when we watch porn, we absolutely cannot realize that, yes, there is actual sex happening, so that people have to be at least somewhat connected. But it's light. It's lit. It's staged. It's processed, it's edited, it's soundtracked, it's this, it's that. We don't have that critical separation. So right. we watch it and we're like, oh my gosh, look at those liberated sex
people. But I think when people look at that, you know, and myself included, sorry, Robert. No, but it's, you know, I think most people look at it as more of a performance, right? I get it when you're looking at a film.
You know, that gets into the second point, is the, also the point about sex education. So we're strange about sex as a culture, and then we have this sex education piece that's both part of it and separate from that, is that people are not educated about sex. Like, you can watch an anal scene in whatever adult content, and generally the application of lube and the... I don't have to say things delicately. So the prep, the anal prep. The
anal prep. Yes, I'm going to cut that down.
Hashtag anal prep.
You don't just, an object is not just inserted through the anal sphincter, like, woo, it doesn't work that way. But we don't see the lube, the prep, the this that happens in porn. We just see the sex, you know? Right. And so without sex education, or with such terrible sex education, such a paltry, terrible, awful sex education, education, both for young people and for adults, a lot of people don't know that you don't just ram it in. Like, that's not the way it works.
Right.
So people see that and they go, oh, okay, is that how you do it? And so people start to kind of conflate these things. I mean, you know that a car can't fly across however many bridge decks and land and be okay.
Right.
We know that. But we don't necessarily know that some sex things don't work the way they are shown in porn. Obviously, all that prep had to happen before, but they're sort of lost on the cutting room floor.
Does it make parents' jobs harder? Like, I have an 8-year-old. She's about to be 9. And
happy birthday.
Thank you. And I go, you know, when this day comes, because there's so much access available mm-hmm. to, and you know, not at that age. I don't, you know, obviously they're not curious.
No,
but
you have an internet, though, and like...
Yeah, exactly. One oops, you know, click right. on something, you know, then you're down the, what I call as a parent, you know, the dark side, yeah. right? And do I get out in front of that, or do I like wait, you know? But I look at the idea of what kids are exposed to and kind of what you're saying, like uh-huh. how there's this social education by right, peers right. And entertainment. So does that make the parents' jobs harder now?
You know, I would say yes and no. Forever, people have always been interested in sex, and kids grow up and turn into adolescents, and that hormone rage, curious, blah thing happens no matter what it has since the dawn of time. Things are way more accessible now if you have a computer. If you don't have a computer, or that computer has some sort of protective block, whatever, right. on it, then you're fine. And the thing about that that's absolutely fascinating is that if you look at just about any adult website nowadays, if you go all the way down to the bottom when they do the 2257 and everybody mm-hmm. here is of age and blah, 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 you will also notice a little tag, a little square logo, and it says RTA blah. And that means restricted to adults. The adult industry, through the ASACP organization, which is the Child Protection No Access Report, mm-hmm. instances of recorded sexual abuse of children, because that stuff does happen, but it generally comes like, it does not come from the professional industry. But the industry organized and created this little software tag that every legit porn company basically has on their site, which means you, as a parent or a computer owner or a person who has a young person around, or right. just an asshole who doesn't want people looking at porn on your computer, you go into the settings and you say, block everything that has this tag. And guess what happens? If you type in pornowhatever.com and it has the RTA tag, you get a nice blank screen that says, you're not allowed to look at this.
Huh.
Yeah. And it's there.
So
and
the tools are there.
The tools have been there for years now, almost 10 years. They exist.
Right.
And you see them. And
but kids are way smarter than their parents, right?
Like, now we're getting into something like there's a point where it's like, yes, kids are way smarter.
I mean, at least technologically speaking,
yes,
right?
For sure, or more savvy. I don't know. But there is, but I mean, you get to a certain point where your job as a parent, in my opinion, I'm not a parent, so you know, take it with a grain of salt what I'm about to say. But where your job as a parent has to start, like the website has done its job. Like there's a place where right. you have to start figuring it out.
It's like the parental advisory sticker on an album.
You can't. I mean, you can still. I remember going and buying those when I was under 17 or whatever. When I was a kid, I was buying tapes at the warehouse.
Oh yeah,
the warehouse. And I can remember going in any number. I remember buying the Warrant Cherry Pie tape cassette.
She's my cherry pie.
Exactly.
Anthony plays bass, by the way, just so you know.
Oh,
so we can get a little session going
after.
You ready?
Okay, cool. Who's going to crawl around in the car?
Robert.
I got it.
You got the frohawk thing on it. It would look good with the contour of a vehicle.
Yes. But I mean, I remember going and getting that. Like, I could get it in spite of the label, in spite of the fact that I had to actually walk into a store and pick it up. I wanted it that bad. I needed that Janie Lane so bad that I went and got it. And my parents didn't stop me. And I sat there and listened to it in my room and was like, yeah. And that's not Warrant's fault.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right.
There's no point where it's, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree. You have a series of books called You Study What?
Yes.
There's three, right? Or four.
The third one's coming.
Yes.
There's two currently available, and I am in the process of copy editing and, third. But yes, it's so not glamorous.
Tell us about the series. Like, I glanced a little bit at it, but you know, tell us what we will find in You Study What?
Stories and adventures of me acting like a jackass. You know, it's
have
it's,
another drink. No, I'm just kidding.
I need some more water. You know, I've been doing this for a really, really long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, the better part of my academic career. And I have not always known everything I know currently. And 5 years from now, I will know things that I don't know now, right? So it's a process. I mean, I didn't just jump in like full bore, everything's okay.
Right.
So, you know, couple that learning process with, you know, when I publish academically, it's very dry. It's very smart sounding. Sometimes I read some of my older papers or papers I haven't looked at in a couple years, and I'm like, what the hell am I talking about? Like, I have to re-remember. I'm like, wow, that's a sentence right there. Dang. So, I mean,
should listen to some of the earlier Innovation Crush episodes.
Yes. So, I mean, there's a lot of my work is, I mean, I write for law journals quite frequently. And if you've ever read like in some kind of law review, like something like that, it's in depth. They have a team of people who copy edit and do the references for you just because they are that extensive, because they're binding
right.
arguments and articles. So that's not something your average person, even myself, wants to pick up and be like, oh, this is an amusing story about whatever happens. So the fact that I've had this learning process, and the fact that so much of my work is kind of embedded and situated in academia and scholarship, I started writing the You Study What's as a tool to kind of talk about all this other stuff. I mean, there's so many stupid stories in there. The first time I went to a porn store in Central Texas because I was doing my background research, and that's when you could still go to a store and really buy DVDs, which you obviously can now, but just stupid stories about me driving up and down the 35 freeway and trying to figure out how I had the courage to go in there and actually buy a porn DVD. So silly. Or, I mean, one of the first adult entertainment expos I went to when I was still doing my ethnographic research, so kind of spying and looking around, and I was working with this company. They had let me come into their place of business and basically be a fly on the wall, but they also expected me to participate, so I had to carry boxes and stack things and drive people around, and it was so not sexy. But there was, when I was at the Adult Entertainment Expo, there was this display of real dolls, and real dolls are the same weight, the same size, the same feeling as a human, and people use them as companions or as, well, they use them as
Lars
companions.
Versus a real girl.
Yes, exactly. That's a real doll. And so they had this display of real dolls up, and somebody was trying to take a picture of the real dolls, and I saw him off in the distance. And I tried to stop the guy, but he leaned in on the real dolls, and there was about six of them, and they fell like...
Dominoes.
Giant, and ripped down the back of the booth that I was supposed to be watching. So now you have, in the middle of a huge convention hall, just swarming with people like ants, you have this completely ripped down back, and people are having meetings in there. Everybody's, like, possessions and things are in there. There's all this stock and product in there, and I'm like... standing
there. You just tiptoed out, like, slowly backed out of the...
Oh, my God. just things like that, and reflections on content and stuff, because, I mean, you write about this stuff, and not all of it's good, some of it's crap, and not all of it sits well with me. Like, I don't find it all appealing or productive, but trying to negotiate, like, what I'm doing as a sociologist with how I actually feel about a lot of stuff, that's also in these You Study What's.
Robert, you studied sociology, correct?
I did, and marketing. Ooh.
Oh, fancy. When you getting your PhD?
Never.
Don't. Don't do it. That's another thing I do, is academic counseling and advising. Grad school is not.
But I think when you, like, because at least from what I hear, right, you're sort of a trailblazer in this sort of area of study and academia.
If I were to disagree with you, I would be being disingenuous. And if I agree with you, I sound like an asshole.
No,
so I'm just going to nod my head.
No, pull it. Be Kanye today. And, like, if you're awesome.
Yes. Yes.
No, because what I think is, I think.
I'm a trailblazer, Chris. I'm a trailblazer.
There you go. There you go.
We
Portland
you.
In the house.
That was my Kanye.
No disrespect to Chantel, but Robert had the best.
I'm going to let you finish.
No, because I think when you say, when you do that, like, I think the PhD gives it validity, right? Like, it kind of is the tip of the spear.
Yes. You know? And that's honestly, in spite of how long it took and how, like, the hoops and the this and the that, like, that's why I finished it. Especially as I kept going further and I realized that, you know, I started out talking about labor rights and occupations. There's so much more. There's law, there's technology, health and safety on set, the implications of content, online access, all of the behind-the-scenes industry politics and stuff. I mean, I could be doing this for the rest of my life and still not get a touch of it, you know, like, really get a handle on it. But, you know, as I started to realize that and realize, like, this really, there was so much work to be done, then, you know, that's how I would kind of pump myself up. I'm like, come on, one more semester.
Right.
We can do it. One more paper, one more revision, one more meeting, you know? But when I'm talking about grad school, I'm talking about, you know, I was last semester, for example, a student comes into my office and is like, can you write me a letter? I'm like, I don't even know your name. You've never been before. But they, yeah, okay, for what? And they want a reference to get into grad school for social work. And, you know, what do I say to that young person who wants to then sign up for 2 to 3 more years of out-of-pocket
debt.
School
exactly.
And debt.
Education.
To go get a social work job. Most social work jobs are funded by the state, by the county. And I'm like, do you know?
Never get out of debt.
Do you know what the budget, county, state of California, LA County, do you have any idea how that's looking right now?
Right.
No. I'm like, and then in 2 to 3 years from now, when you're done, after you've paid even more expensive than right now as an undergrad, have you thought about that? No.
Mom, Dr. Tibbles told me not to go to finish school.
My professor told me that I don't need to go to grad school. And it's obviously everybody's choice, but, I mean, just to get people to think a bit more critically about.
And I think that's the other side of education, right, is, like, the practicalities of life, you know, given a particular area or direction of choice.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to the mall, the Northridge Mall right now, and to any store and find yourself a – college graduate working there. And I mean, retail is amazing and it's great and whatever, and all, you know, jobs and experiences and all that's awesome. But I'm willing to bet that the pitch that was sold those young people when they started going to college and started doing that was not manager at Charlotte Russe. Like, I'm just guessing.
Right.
Right, right.
And shout out to the manager.
Yeah, woo, whoever you are. That person was not one of my students, unless, like, that'd be crazy serendipity.
What does research involve for you? Because you talk about all these vast, you know, pockets of the industry that you work in. You know, how much of it is in the field, right? You know, and seeing, like, what happens on a set versus what happens in real life, or how much of it is kind of like hard research and Googling statistics and things like that, or conducting your own, you know, studies, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, I don't know if I could really give you a breakdown, but I can tell you what I do. I go to sets. I go to shows. I go to business meetings. I go to any kind of community kind of thing that I can to see what's going on. I look through boards and see conversations like message boards and stuff like that, because there's so much stuff that happens, like, off the public record,
right.
Like the industry politics. I watch a lot of content. It's interesting to kind of see the full breadth of what's out there. When people are producers or performers, they get kind of, I mean, like anything, you get sort of stuck in your own work. So if you're a musician, you're really familiar with your music or things like it. So if you're a producer, you know your stuff or things that are your competitors. But porn is so vast and so varied, and just the content as a text,
right,
regardless of how people then take that text and what they internalize or use from it, like, that's a whole nother separate set of something.
Yeah.
So
no, it's interesting because, you know, I think when you and I talked earlier, a lot of, you know, studies or anecdotally people have said that porn sort of leads the way in market trends, right? So when you look at, like, all the niche pieces of adult entertainment you can look at or find or subscribe to, the same thing happens in YouTube, right? Like, or digital video, or just any sort of, like, more and more niches are popping up and blowing up, like,
right.
So I guess, can you kind of just speak to that, like, because there's a constant need to leapfrog yourself and find those pockets of opportunity.
Well, I think especially with like YouTube-y type of content and access, and as that stuff develops, you know, we'll call it 2005 to 2012-ish, that area in there. I think that's actually, porn dropped the ball really bad there. Before, they were always the, you know, technology innovators, because they kind of had to stay a step ahead of the game.
Right.
Because people won't credit card process them. They won't let them have their businesses in certain areas. People won't rent to them, blah, 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 blah. So there was a lot of workarounds and whatever. But something happened with the internet and the ball got dropped there. And that's kind of interesting to see people trying to recover from that now. People are trying, but with piracy and tube sites and stuff like that, there's a lot of tension and a lot of people are really hurting.
So there's no revenue generated from the Pornhubs of the world, or
that's funny that you ask about Pornhub. Is owned by this company formerly known as Manwin, now currently known as MindGeek. I think they're attempting to rebrand themselves. And actually, Pornhub, the vast majority of content that's on Pornhub is pirated, meaning that a third party somewhere goes and either rips a DVD or finds a file behind somebody's paywall, whatever, and uploads it for free. Pornhub, in the meantime, doesn't charge for that, and people are like, woo, free, blah, blah, blah. But if you want to see it at higher quality, then you sign in.
No, thanks.
Or there's all of the ad dollars that they get, and this, that, and the other. So people are flocking to tube sites for the free porn. The people who produce the porn, your favorite lady that you like to see, or your favorite director who just has that particular eye that does it so well for you, they're not getting paid for any of that, which then makes less work and less content that you like. In the meantime, sites like Pornhub are getting revenue from these streams that they have separate. So that's why you start to see all of these DMCA companies, a good example.
What's DMCA?
It means Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and a DMCA notification If something of yours has been if something of yours has been pirated online and you're the copyright holder, the onus of the responsibility to get that material taken down is on you. So say one of my books was pirated on this literary website. It will stay up there and people will be able to read it for free and do whatever and take it and do whatever until I or somebody who acts in my stead goes and issues a DMCA takedown notification. Mm. So, and then they are legally required to take it down. So what we started seeing happening was all of these tube sites popped up and they were populated with everybody's content, and people in porn were like, what do we do with this? I mean, people in mainstream don't even know about how to work this kind of stuff.
Right.
You know, people in porn, oh my God, we just used to make naked people videos and now we have to do this.
Yeah, now have to have a briefcase.
Yeah, so that's now we start to see all of these organizations that this is their job, this is what they do. A company hires them, contracts them, and they go through the tube sites and take stuff down. And you know, in some ways, I guess it pisses consumers off because you don't get to watch porn for free. But at the same time, if you don't pay for your porn, then there's not going to be any more porn left.
Yeah.
So, so you know, there's that and that kind of thing. But the question you were asking about kind of content and wider culture sort of reflecting with one another, that's a really interesting relationship. You know, people talk about porn as if it's this bubble, you know, like it's sort of doing its own thing separately.
Right.
And then in the same breath, people will tell you that these evil pornographers are creating all of this depraved content to make us want to, like, I don't know, have sex with the couch over there. I couldn't think of it as an object.
You saw our last podcast.
Yes. Yes, I did. I saw you guys. And it was but it's interesting because it's not really the way it works. So what you see is, like, you know, Anchorman, for example, it's a mainstream movie, and then you'll see a parody of it. Or, you know, there is somebody who's in the mainstream news, and then somebody will make a sex tape offer, or she'll actually approach an adult company and do something like that. You start to see these interesting tensions where stuff kind of pops up and where there's really a synergy between content development and culture and right. What's happening in, like, the news.
Have any of the like the major, you know, production companies or, you know, things like that, have they ever approached a site like StubHub, Pornhub?
Not StubHub.
Tickets to live shows.
Oh my God, that's an idea.
Yeah, there we go. We just came, we always come up with ideas on this show. We
Innovation crush.
Made about $1 million worth of businesses.
But no, have they like tried to approach like a Pornhub and kind of get them to be on the same page with like the copyright stuff and the same way that like YouTube would give admin access to people and, you know, let them like a Sony and
right. So you can like claim your content and
yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of this is probably more than I should say. There's a lot of interesting
nobody's listening.
There's a lot of interesting negotiations that have happened. And really and truly, in my view of it, a lot of them are kind of like entrapment. So you have a site, a tube site. And you know, Pornhub, I hate even saying the word out loud.
You porn, how about that one?
That's the same.
Just trying to give you some options.
No, so any one of these sites, they're all owned by the same company too. Any one of these sites, they then they pull all this traffic such that people are like, why would I go to, you know, TashaRain.com directly when I can just go there and right. watch it for free? So then all of a sudden, there's a negotiation between the content producer and the tube site that says, hey, if you advertise on here, then we won't pirate your stuff. Or, okay, so we won't pirate your stuff, but we're now going to rev share. So I'm not going to pirate it, but behind the paywall, I'll put your stuff and we are going to now share it. And people are like,
shifty.
So weird.
Yeah,
that's shifty.
It's extremely shifty. And there is so part of the reason why. And this is just my opinion, so, you know, take it for what it's worth. I think part of the reason why MindGeek is, you know, rebranding, why Manwin changed its name to MindGeek and is now doing that, is because their former owner got busted for tax evasion and all this other stuff. They're a Canadian company. And after all of this, how should we say, business model development that they had done.
Business innovation?
Yeah. I guess. Yeah, no. And after all of this had happened, they actually started to get kind of a bad rap through Manwin. So they changed their name. I honestly think it is a rebranding effort to distance themselves, but it's the same damn thing.
I was going to say, you can change your name, but if you don't change what you're doing...
But people don't know it. And then if you think about it, you're like, MindGeek. Well, that sounds like a cute little... that's like an app company. It makes apps for my phone. MindGeek is awesome. And MindGeek does not. MindGeek owns several porn production companies that it bought, like, cut off at the knees, low price. It owns all of those tube sites and various other ventures and things. And it's interesting... because it was actually a Nightline episode that was on last night. Yesterday was the 10th, so on April 10th, ABC Nightline, they did a little 7-minute blip about how piracy is affecting the industry. And one thing that the reporter said as part of the segment was, we had a really difficult time getting people to come forth and speak about this because... You know, when you have somebody who owns a lion's share of the production, if you're like, no, you can't pirate my stuff, and Manwin and MindGeek are doing this,
right?
Well, then Manwin and MindGeek will just stop hiring you because that's the vast majority of the work. And it's people are really stuck in like rock and hard place. It's a nasty situation.
You know, but I think at the same time, you know, in other industries, right, that's where the opportunity for innovation happens, right? Where where there's people start to become inventive about creating other revenue streams for themselves. You know, you look at most musicians, right? They like their money comes from touring now. Like record sales are just 100%. Marketing tactics.
Yeah, and you see people who have toy lines that they then like sell with their content. You see people who are doing different kinds of media stuff, radio shows, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of people are actually getting, not a lot of people, but a handful of very powerful women performers, Jessica Drake, Lisa
Every time you say handful, I get immature.
Sorry. The gesture of me holding up my hand exactly. Handful that people can't see, but I was doing. I apologize.
I also get very immature when I'm at Starbucks and they go, sausage sandwich? And I laugh, and then I'm like, I feel very alone in those
moments. I am in sixth grade. you're probably not alone, Chris. There's a small handful. There's no gesture. There are some women performers who are moving into like sex education and stuff like that. So you see people rebranding and branching out and doing different things. And, you know, that's interesting. But those are exceptions. Those are not the rule. So there is innovation for sure.
Right.
But there's also, you know, the any number of companies that are gone because I guess they didn't keep up, you know, up.
Well, so, I mean, I think every industry has its 1%, right? Like, you know, there's a bunch of people that have tried and failed and reached certain levels of success and or failure and bounce back, right? You look at Larry Flint.
Right. who is the biggest proponent of free speech out there. Yeah. And, you know, that guy, we as a culture owe him a huge debt.
Like, that's true.
Part of the reason why we get to say fuck on the air is because of Mr. Flint. And
thank you. Thank you, Larry.
Thank you, sir.
You and I were talking earlier about fans and fan interaction and how appreciative the talent is of certain interactions. Can you just talk a little bit about that, you know, and just how those fan relationships are different than sort of mainstream celebrity or brand interactions with their fans, right?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously anybody who's in the public eye probably really likes fans, you know, back in the old school days when people still do this, but when people used to go do signings at, you know, a sex toy store in Kansas somewhere, like it was an opportunity to meet fans, but things have changed. You know, there's big convention shows that we didn't used to have across the United States. And that's interesting to get a fan interaction, but really social media has enabled people who probably never would see their favorite performer, or and it's not just performers, their favorite director, their favorite producer, or their favorite industry personality, probably never get to see or talk to that person in real life. They now get to have an interaction with them. And, you know, I think that's really important to members of the adult community for two reasons. The first is that people hate people who work in porn. I mean, banks close their accounts randomly. Like I said, people won't rent to them. oh yeah, Chase Bank, I'm talking to you, Citibank as well, over and over again.
Wow.
I have a stockpile, really? FYI, Chase Bank and Citibank. Every time it happens, I write it down and I keep the archive. Well,
what's the reasoning? We'll get back to where we're going. What's the reasoning?
Allegedly, it violates their terms of service because it's a sex-related business. There's actually, I read something very interesting from a performer named Kieran Lee, who just in the past week, he had his business account closed. He doesn't do anything illegal.
Yeah.
Had his business account closed. But when he went in there, like, pissed off, then the next thing he was told was, but we'd really like to keep your personal account business, Mr. Real Name, sir.
Really?
So the discrimination is outlandish. It's absolutely insane. So I think that when members of the industry get that, because, I mean, people can have, like, a pseudonym or an avatar, and they're not putting, like, Chantel Tibbles, this is my address, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Necessarily, they can be whatever they are, whatever their name is, but there's still a person behind that avatar that's actually supporting them. I mean, Lisa Ann has over 600,000 Twitter followers. Like, that's 600,000 people who actively choose on a public platform with an email address attached to it that then has an ISP somewhere, actively choose to support her.
That's where I get... That's
insane.
Yeah, and because it's such a taboo thing, I would imagine. Like Robert, you know, he has a very private folder on this computer that I found. And
how'd you find it?
No, you find anything. You look hard enough there, buddy.
Damn it.
But there's that part, that, like, really human part about it. But I think also the reason why it's so important, the interaction, and why people who do media marketing and social media marketing really should take a moment and learn from those, like, you know, key adult performers who really have their social media developed, because it gives you bargaining power in your industry. There's the classic example is this performer named Christy Mack. Nobody had heard of her. Nobody knew. Nobody this, nobody that. But boy, did that girl know how to do her social media to the point where she had hundreds of thousands of followers. And Christy Mack, who had very few scenes, very little, like, longevity in the industry leading up, got a fleshlight, got a this, got a that, and has, I mean, those are big, getting a fleshlight is a big deal in the adult industry. And she was able to really, like, bargain because she came with this flock of followers who were going to buy her stuff and support her endeavors and things like that. So it really gives performers control of their business and control of their brand where they didn't have before. So fan interaction is, I think it's important twofold. It's important because it's, like, humanizing, but it's also important because it allows a performer to show that they have a market value.
Do you know if any of the social networking sites have deleted their accounts, like, randomly, the same way that the banks have?
And, like, that Facebook? Facebook is, talking to you, Facebook. Facebook likes to change its terms of service. Facebook
all
also
the time.
Like,
we have great
all
tags
the...
on this. On the, so. Facebook, Chase Bank.
Citibank. Facebook likes to change its terms of service. And Facebook also seems, if somebody complains about something, then they'll just shut it down. A few years back, there was this absolutely wonderful movie made by Burning Angel, which is Joanna Angel's production company, called Doppelganger. And I remember it because it was so clever. It was Joanna Angel, and she had this terribly cheesy blow-up doll, like, from a sex toy company had manufactured, like, just the most ridiculous, terrible, low-rent, low-budget Joanna Angel blow-up doll. So they took that doll and they made this film Doppelganger about what happens when your sex toy doll turns evil.
Right.
And so the doll is evil. And, like, it's so well done. It is so hilarious. It's still, like, one of the funniest things I've ever seen. And there was a picture on Facebook of Joanna Angel, like, her little smiley face and her little pink hair, looking adorable like she always is, with her blow-up doll. And her blow-up doll didn't have a top on. This is like little kid inner tube plastic.
Right.
And Facebook flagged the image, froze her account for a bit. Something like, there was this whole big kerfuffle because of the nude doll.
Reference, if you will.
Doll. Like, really?
But I think it would be different if I put up that picture versus her putting it up, right?
And that's discrimination.
Right.
That's inequality right there. Like, I could too probably put a picture of me standing there with the Joanna Angel blow-up doll, Actually, for me, probably people would complain. I mean, I just
wrote down a complaint.
Yeah, there. Right. No, I used to actually have a Facebook page that was more centered on my blog work and less about me as a writer. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, I hate to say, but a lot of money developing this because Facebook was a platform. And this was probably like 2010 or 11.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, one day, gone. No amount of calling, talking, this, that, just gone. La-di-da. So, and I don't, I'm obviously, I'm not a porn performer. There's no nakedness, nothing's happening. I'm just writing about the sex industry in a critical way. So just the idea of engaging it for at least one person, it was so mind-boggling that they had to complain, which, okay. But yeah, so there's a lot of, Instagram is another one. Vine just recently changed its terms of service. And, you know, it's applicable to all people, but if you think about who uses that app more, who are the top of Viners out there before Vine changed its TOS, you know, there was a calculated purpose behind that.
I guess that, I guess that happens on a lot of the, like, the newer platform, or any platform, really. It's just kind of like, you know, you set out for it to be one thing, and then people abuse it. There was a guest we had on before, Robin Kaminsky, and she talked about, you know, she worked on the launch of The Sims, the whole video, and she's like, guess what the number one activity people do when they're building their homes and towns and, you know, lives in The Sims?
Tell us.
Sex.
Of course.
So it's like, you know, that's all.
What did you think was going to happen?
This is mass perversion of our entire country. But so when we started off this conversation, you talked a lot about, like, the downside of the sex work industry, right? Where you, you know, whether it's kidnapping or trafficking.
That's not sex work industry.
Right, right.
That's
totally. Well, no, because there are organizations out there, like, you know, one, for instance, I know of called Treasures, right? They'll go to strip clubs and quote-unquote rescue workers from this life, right? Can you kind of just speak to the, you know, the, I'm going to call them naysayers for now, but not that they're necessarily naysayers, because I don't think every, like, in any other industry, like, there's going to be the people who are super positive in the industry, and then the people that are, like, you know, they probably shouldn't be for a myriad of reasons.
Right.
But
so you mean just like anti-porn activism or something?
Yeah, exactly. Like, where's the balance?
You know, it's an interesting kind of conundrum, because everybody's entitled to their opinion. I mean, in no way, shape, or form do I think the adult industry is trying to make everybody like porn. And I know, because I know myself, I know what I think. There's no way that you can convince people to like everything. So that's cool. Like, if people don't want to like adult content, or they don't want it, then that's great and fine and a perfectly valid perspective. What starts to happen, though, where it kind of crosses the line, in my opinion, is where you start to get value judging of individuals. Just because somebody's doing something that you don't like doesn't mean that they don't have to like it.
Right.
And when it gets into that realm, or when it gets into people trying to kind of think or co-opt the perspective of somebody, oh, you know, you poor young girl, or you poor person, or you poor lady, like, you don't want this, blah, blah, blah. That's not for somebody to say.
Right.
You know, it's not. And a lot of times you see an arc. You know, people get into the industry and then they stop and they just kind of go away. That's fine. Sometimes people really change their minds and they are like, no, this was not what I wanted. And I think this gets back to what we were talking about close to the beginning about our discomfort with sex. There's a few instances I can think of, a number of examples where you have somebody who was in the industry, who was seemingly doing well, whatever, and then all of a sudden, or maybe not all of a sudden, just the announcement came suddenly,
right,
where that person is like, no, I don't like porn anymore, anti-porn, anti-porn. And that's fine. I mean, people, I'll sit here and tell you bad stories about academia all day long.
Sure.
But that's not the same thing as somebody victimizing you, nor is it the same thing, nor is it comparable to a bad experience or trying to convince people that their experience currently is not for them or wrong.
Yes.
So, you know, it's interesting. I think... I can think of a couple examples in particular of anti-porn activists that, you know, they're anti-porn activist academics, actually.
Your colleagues.
yeah, my colleagues that really give both academia and sociology in particular a really bad name, because, you know, they make these outlandish claims and they're like, I have a PhD. Outlandish claim. And it really feeds into fear, loathing, discomfort, whatever it is. And people kind of eat this stuff up.
Right.
And it's so poorly done or so value judgy or whatever. And I personally think it's a tactic to keep some people in a job, because if nobody was pissed off about it, then what would you do?
Right. But realistically, though, you know, and I worked at Playboy mm-hmm. years ago.
What?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
Thanks for the invite.
Hey, I didn't know you then, man. Sorry. But, you know, there is, and I think you're right, there's the individual's journey, right, mm-hmm. through whether it's drugs or alcohol or whatever they feel is a coping mechanism, and other people are 100% comfortable, and this is who they are. And then there's also, not that I've experienced or seen it personally, but, at least the theory is that there are some individuals, men and or women, that are in the business somewhat against their will, right? Or, and is that true?
No, that is not true. There are some people in the business who are jerks. There are, in my experience, they are so few and far between, but that doesn't mean I don't know everybody. There are some people who are assholes. There are some people who do jerk things. There are some people who are like, do this, else I won't book you again. Like, that happens. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, and in 10 plus years I've been doing this, that is such a small fraction of the community. There's also instances, and I mean, you got to talk about this in terms of humanity. I mean, there are people who get into porn not because they want to, but because they're busted. Like, mm-hmm. they need, especially back in the mid-2000s when you could get in, do a few scenes, get out, and be whatever. It was that woman who was the junior high school teacher in Oxnard, Stacey Hallis was her name. And oftentimes when I hear somebody, you know, who's, I was in 200 scenes and I hated it the entire time. And I'm like, yeah, bullshit. But this woman literally, I mean, her archive was so far buried, and she literally was only in 6 or 7 scenes. And her story was that she was broke. You know, she was trying to go to school. She was this, she was that. And she
There's been a lot of mainstream celebrities who have been in adult. Like, Sylvester Stallone is one that's rumored to have been in.
I mean, if you look
the Italian
IMDb,
Stallion.
If you look on IMDb, that's his first film credit. I'm just saying.
Is it still there?
I think so. I don't know. Maybe it was a long time ago that I saw it. But so there are people who are doing the work out of desperation. Like, that does happen. But I mean, I waited tables and bartended at a shitty club on 6th Street in Austin and, you know, served shots to frat boys. Not because I found it fulfilling work,
right.
But because I needed a damn job.
Well, you make a great point, too. Is like, you can find jerk bosses or jerk employers or jerk coworkers anywhere you go.
Jerks are everywhere.
Right? And that's why there are sexual harassment laws in, mm-hmm. you know, everyday or traditional workplaces. Right. So on and so forth. So I'm going to read the statistic that I ran into earlier. Right now, 30,000 people are watching porn, and to meet that vast demand, a new porn video is produced every 39 minutes. Why are we so hungry for this stuff?
Oh, for variety.
Because we've talked about how much is taboo.
Yeah.
Right? But then, like, we're obviously viewing it. A lot.
You know,
every 39 minutes.
God damn it, every 39 minutes. And that doesn't sound like an outlandish number.
No, it doesn't. That's what's surprising. Like, it's big, but it's like when you given the industry and the content, like, okay, it makes sense. But like, where does the cultural obsession come from?
How to explain this succinctly? I think, and this is just my theory, although there's a lot of discussion about porn for women happening right now and feminist porn and stuff like that, the vast majority of content leading up and content currently still produced is either for the male gaze, for the eyes of the man, be it gay porn or heterosexual porn, whatever. It's for dudes. porn for dudes.
Yeah, and, oh, go dudes.
And even, I mean, there's a lot of people who speculate even this idea of porn for women. Is it really for women or is it for guys to be like, hey, don't you want to watch this? Hey.
Right.
Like, so, you know, and I could push back on that with many examples of really like beautiful, uplifting content that gets categorized as porn for women and as a lot of really amazing stuff that's just quote unquote porn.
I think porn for women is like Sex and the City.
You know, porn for women is like Sex in the City is probably more titillating.
Or shopping.
Or shop or getting your nails done. Do my nails and shop me. Yeah. Sorry, I got distracted.
No, it was my fault.
But I know, I was distracting though. But the idea that a lot of porn is intended for a man consumer, right? So you have that. And then when you think about, and this is like everybody gets all sort of up in arms about nature versus nurture. But there are some nature arguments that may factor into this. Namely, in the animal kingdom, male animals like to spread their
stuff
wide, right? Lots of variety, lots of this, lots of that. And I think there's some thread connecting that with this desire for new stimulus that like people are like, I want a new chick. I need to see a new, I want to like, I've already jerked off to her twice. Oh my gosh, that's one time too many. Where's the next one?
come on.
And then if you think about the way we are now, I mean like scrolling through Twitter, clicking on things, God damn it, this page doesn't load fast enough. I won't read this.
Right.
Move on to the next thing, blah, blah, blah. So I think there's like a guy component, a porn, who it's marketed to or maybe what it's trying to tap into, coupled with all of these shifts that we see in our culture and the demand is nuts.
Yeah,
and people want more. And I mean, trust me when I tell you this, that people are not producing porn to be like, la-di-da, I made this art film. Like, I mean, some people are, that's part of it, but it's a product. And if there's no demand for the product, one, the business is going to go under, and two, like, people aren't going to spend their time doing it. So, you know, we as a culture demand this. And I think there's a little, you know, I haven't really worked all that out, but I think that that's probably mistily associated with.
Yeah, no, it's like our appetite for it. And I think it's also, it's one of those things that kind of grows exponentially because it was so taboo. Like, I remember, you know, trying to sneak a VCR tape out of the, you know, out of the machine when I was in high school or whatever versus, you know, the mass availability of it now. And I think as we get exposed to more things, they become more and more accepted. Right?
Yeah. I mean, remember when you got your first phone and you're like, oh my God, this phone, I'm going to have it for 2.5 years. And it was like this treasure. And
I'm going to fulfill my entire contract.
I'm like, oh shit, I dropped my phone. It's time to get a new one.
Exactly.
5S, 5, 5S.
This thing dials the wrong number. What do you do in your spare time?
I run. I do a lot of yoga. I got a new puppy recently.
What's the puppy's name?
So cute. Her name is Sugar.
Sugar?
Yes, she's so cute.
There's a lot of alliteration there. Sugar, Chantel.
Yeah, but yeah, she's not like Sugar with a CH. She's Sugar with an S.
That'd be weird, yeah. It'd be Chugar.
Chugar.
Yes.
Chugar!
Yeah, she's really cute, though. She's a rescue.
Oh.
And she's 7 months old, and she is, I don't know if you can see these little chew marks I have on my ass.
You are the chew toy.
Yeah, she's still
learning. Is it a Rottweiler? What?
She's a little bully mix. Cute little.
Nice.
She's a little soft, adorable thing. But she's actually quite huge. She was just recently taken to the vet for a little puppy checkup. She weighs 44 pounds.
That is a huge dog.
That's a big dog. And she still looks like a goof because her paws still look huge.
Right.
Which means she's probably going to get bigger.
Is that why you're running so much, just in case you run from the dog?
No, so I can keep up with her. She's going to be my little running sidekick. Yeah, no, I do a lot of that. I don't know. Lots of things.
That's great. So take this conversation in, breathe it all in. So you do a lot of yoga. You're grounded, centered, chakras, et cetera, et cetera. The show's called Innovation Crush. We talk about things that we crush on that are innovative. What out there do you see that you love as a trend, either in your industry or not in your industry? It could just be, you know, I won't fill in the blank for you. But
oh, man, things that I love as a trend. I love Twitter. Like, I know that's not like a new thing, but I love Twitter. I love the power that Twitter gives people. I think it's fantastic. I love the like packaging, cross marketing, and different product development that's happening in adult right now as people are trying to diversify. It always made me kind of sad, and it makes me sad to still make the point where I'm like, yeah, porn kind of dropped the ball in the mid-2000s with the technology thing. But I see it bouncing back, and I see a lot of that as people getting creative, be it through Kickstarter or, well, excuse me, not Kickstarter, Offbeater. Porn has its own Kickstarter called Offbeater. Well, because Kickstarter won't allow people with...
Again. Offbeater. So. I'm writing.
Offbeater, and it's like... The beater part, there's no second E, so it just ends in an R. And it's like an amazing platform where people can go and do their thing and like pitch their project and all of that. So you see people really kind of, you know, getting the movie tie-in with the toy, with this, with the that, and marketing themselves in different ways.
Like it's a multi-platform movement. Like, you know, and it's funny, you don't necessarily think of, like I said, just the cross-pollinization, if I can choose that word. but no, just cross-pollinization across multiple industries and, like you said, packaging a particular star. And
I love open access journals, too.
What's an like, open access journal?
I think that they're going to refine themselves here directly. But an open access journal, because in addition to all this porn stuff, I do actually do like scholarship things, and I write, you know, whatever. And generally, in conventional academic journals, you have to have a very pricey subscription. So you get it like at a university or whatever. So you see things that only other academics or university students have access to. Open access journals and most big presses, you know, be it Sage or Routledge or something like that, they have OA journals now where actually the person publishing, so like it would be me in this case if I submitted something to you, pay a fee. But then everybody has access to your stuff. There's a lot of bugs working out. There was something actually really recently, it was in Science or Scientific American, where a snarky, sassy, like, biologist wrote a totally fake paper. Like, fake name, fake data, fake this, fake that. And just, I mean, just anybody with a basic 11th grade understanding of chemistry would be like, this is not...
Like, no.
This doesn't happen, right? And they submitted it to an open access journal. And they accepted it.
Oh, wow.
Which is like, wow, so why would I like this? I think that the idea of open access journals really fits in with not like free information, but this idea that scholarship really needs to kind of reach out to the community and to like the general population. Sure. Academics are so insular, so up their own asses all the time, so locked in the university that there's not really any interaction with the quote unquote real world. So I think this piece of open access journals is evidence of at least awareness of the need to branch out. And I think as time, you know, the next couple of years, people are really going to figure it out, and it really will, you know, the 2-year lag to get an academic publication might stop.
Right.
The dated references and, you know, esoteric language might,
I think the interesting side for you, though, is also that you're touching on an area that's widely consumed, right? Most, I'll call them colleagues again, you know, are kind of like the backroom studies, clinical, et cetera, et cetera. But yours is, you know, obviously like a broader social approach. And like I said, the sociology and how, why we act the way we act about certain things. So kudos to you.
Thank you.
As an innovator, you know.
I'm an innovator.
Exactly. That's how you got booked on the show. That's the only criteria. You don't have to answer this in too much detail, but how do you make your money? Like where, like, because I think when a lot of people are first, right, there's it's hard to figure out where the opportunities for to really generate income. You have a lot of value, you know, conversationally and socially and so on and so forth. But where do you kind of like, all right, this is my service or this is what I do and you will pay me for this?
Yes, it is difficult, I will tell you. I teach. I'm currently not teaching because my plate is so full. Right. But, you know, that's the bread and butter of any academic is to teach. I teach my books. I do a lot of consulting, which is actually quite fun and interesting. On a daily basis, I will get I'm not even going to give you a number, more than I care to deal with emails from people. Tell me about this. Tell me about that. How right. do I do this? How do I do that? I'm a grad student and I want to study this. I don't know. Blah, blah, blah. Tell me about that. Blah, blah, blah. So I do a lot of, you know, I call it virtual office hours where I talk to people.
Right.
You know, it's essentially like small micro consulting.
That's super valuable.
Yeah. But then I also do bigger sort of social organizational analysis. I have kind of a private consulting business that I do where started out mostly in construction, ironically enough, where people would be like, "This, there's money bleeding out the door.
Right.
What is happening?" I'm like, "Well, that's because your labor superintendent can't access his email on his phone in his office because you have this huge filing cabinet and it's blocking the signal. So he's going out there, he's staying outside smoking for however many hours, and that's one bleed of money." So I go into businesses.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I go into businesses and I sit there for a little while and I check it out and I see and I talk and I figure out, like, maybe if you turned the computer screen just 6 more inches, that person would stop playing so much Candy Crush or whatever. It's just little things that people don't see, you know, and because, you know, as a, like when I was in school and when I really started in sociology and really when I found my love of it, I mean, I love watching people. I love looking at, like, sticky, interesting things, and I love my work. But I really am sort of an occupational and organizational structure sociologist like, at its core. And, yeah, I do a lot of that. It's awesome. So
that is no, because it's
funny.
Yeah, no, I love it. Just how, like, how, you know, we try to make a lot of parallels on the show and, like, how certain principles and things apply to, you know, a more broader audience. So, and I think just, like, Even looking at something as that's as disjointed infrastructurally as the adult industry, and like you've seen everything that could possibly go wrong, and you can apply that to, you know, an office space like this, and go, you can spot the
you would be so amazed at just, you know, a week of time in a business in an industry that I'm not even familiar with. Like I said, I mean, I've
fresh eyes,
yeah, and just what you can see and just little tiny tweaks that really help people.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting and not like, you know, because there used to be those like time management studies where someone would come in there and be like, oh, you know, you're using 10 staplers and you should be using 6 or whatever. And people kind of feared for their jobs.
Right.
That's not something I do, nor is it something that I would ever do. What I do is more figure out how, kind of like the
efficiencies,
the feng shui of a business as it works in a daily, like on a daily.
There's
basis.
A quote I heard over the weekend, which was sweat the small stuff and the big stuff will happen.
That's interesting.
Finish this phrase for me. Innovation to me is
power.
Ooh.
Sorry.
Don't apologize for power. How so?
Well, I mean, if you can innovate and you can stay ahead of the curve, then you can lead and you can stay successful and you can stay fresh, I would say. I mean, that's just my theory. And then you can work for yourself.
That's true.
And yeah.
I try to stay fresh too. Robert, do you have anything?
What is your favorite quote?
Oh, wow.
Weren't expecting that, were you?
I love it. I'm trying to decide if I want to give you a quote from Zach Wilde or a quote from the Feminist Mystique.
Both. or whichever one comes to mind first.
The one that came to mind, it's actually, this is going to make me really sad. But since I'm on my Kanye,
yes.
I'm going to stay on my Kanye. My favorite quote, the quote that's on the cover of my dissertation, is actually something that's very deeply connected to me and my family. It's a quote from Zakk Wylde. For those of you who are not familiar with Zakk Wylde, he's a guitarist for Ozzy Osbourne for the longest time.
Did you know that, Anthony?
And he has this song that he wrote for his dad, and part of the chorus of the song says, "Thank God I am the chosen one."
That's good.
You and
Sean Teasy.
Sorry.
Are you going to have your own shoe line pretty soon?
No, I'm not. And I feel funny. I actually feel quite funny telling you guys that, but that's the first quote that came to my mind.
No, that's a great good. Quote.
Yeah.
Speaking of the chosen one, thank you for accepting our invitation
thank
to be
you
on
for
the show.
Invitation.
This is great.
Great show.
How can people find you?
Well, people can find me on my website. It's ChantelTibbles.com, and I'm sure there will be a spelling of my 17-letter name somewhere near this. But yes, there's that. If you want your business consulted, or if you have a question about school, or you want to know more about the adult industry, I'm there. I'm always on Twitter too, @DrChantel.
All right. Well, thank you guys. This has been another episode of Innovation Crush.
Yeah.
Innovation Crush.
I threw you off on that one, didn't I?
You did.
All right. See you guys. Bye.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore because it's here and it's funny. And I love you.